Right. Well, I'm Eddie.
I'm Noah.
Welcome to the Cosa Nostra.
And today we are doing
1993
is the night before Christmas. This
directed
is
by
Henry Selick. We'll get into that. Based on the characters by Tim Burton. And yeah. So okay, when
was this not co-directed by?
Should we get into it now?
Yeah.
Okay.
He had quite a lot of creative control.
Yeah, okay. Because it's kind of hard to explain it without, like... Okay. Let's start with, when was the first time you saw this
movie? Jeez. It's one of those movies that everyone's seen at some point.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to track down. I remember re-watching it recently. Last Christmas. It's a Christmas movie.
Really?
I don't want to hear it's a Halloween movie. It's a Christmas movie.
Oh, no. Because, like... Okay, I've always...
at Christmas. That is the rule of
thumb. No, but it's set at Halloween.
Yeah, but then it's set at Christmas. It's over the period.
Yeah, but it's mostly just like... It's like all the characters are Halloween and like... It's
but they're doing a Christmas.
I mean, look at the poster.
We're not doing Die Hard, but for Nightmare
Before Christmas. No, but Die Hard is...
Undoubtedly a Christmas
movie. Yeah, it's undoubtedly a Christmas movie.
I don't care that all the ones that came after weren't Christmas movies. It's a Christmas movie.
No, this is like... This is even, like, harder than, like, saying, like, if Gremlins is, like, a Christmas movie.
Gremlins is a Christmas movie.
I don't even know about that.
Gremlins is a Christmas movie.
Yeah.
It's, like, a Christmas Halloween movie released in July. I don't know.
It has the key heart film. This film is, what a weird, like, a Halloween, Christmas, weird amalgamation child made with and released during summer.
Well, no, October. So, like, again, we'll get into the release as well. But, so with this movie, to explain why, like, it's not, like, directed by Tim Burton and it's, like, the way it is. So, Tim Burton came up with the idea for this movie while he was, like, an animator at Disney. He was part of, like, that cohort that had been, like, taken from CalArts to the Disney studio to, like, have bringing new life into this studio that was just basically dying at this point. And he worked on different projects there. He worked on 1982's Vincent.
Yeah.
He made the 1983 Hansel and Gretel TV special, which was a TV special with Hansel and Gretel, but everybody is Japanese in that one. I don't know why, but okay.
Ooh.
And
that's
and he made 1984's Frankenweenie, and all these projects was kind of like to keep him invigorated at Disney because he really just did not like the Disney style that he was working on. Like the first movie he worked on was The Fox and the Hound, which if you ever see that movie,
it's not him.
It's just not him.
Also kind of a weird movie.
It's not amazing, but I look at it and I'm like, this is not Tim Burton. He was put on to be an animator on the. I forget her name, but I think it's like Vixie or something.
Did he not work on The Black Cauldron?
So he works on this one, and he's put on to work on... he works on animating the Lady Fox in that movie. And then after that, he moves on to the production of a movie that had been like in production for like 10 years at that point, The Black Cauldron. And that is a movie that technically should suit his style more. And he works on that one. He creates a lot of crazy concept art for that. But Disney ends up not actually using any of it because it was just too weird to actually work with the Disney style. Even when he gets teamed up with Disney animator Andrea Stasia, it still doesn't really work out. And he ends up making Frankenweenie in 1984. And that movie, that short film is originally supposed to go with Pinocchio in its 1984 re-release. But when it gets sent to the MPAA, it is given a PG. And Pinocchio is a G-rated movie, so Disney can't put it with Pinocchio. And it was kind of at that point where Disney's like, okay, we gave you like $1 million to make Frankenweenie, and we can't even release this movie. We're kind of done with you now. And although I think Pinocchio is much scarier than Frankenweenie.
Yeah.
They decide like, okay, Tim Burton and Disney decide to part ways, okay? But Tim Burton came up with the idea for Nightmare Before Christmas at Disney. And the kind of thing that what happens, if you create an idea there at Disney, they own that idea. So he didn't own The Nightmare Before Christmas. So when he left Disney, he left The Nightmare Before Christmas behind. And he goes on to make Pee-wee's Big Adventure in 1985. That's a big success. Beetlejuice in 88.
Yeah,
that's
Pee-wee's,
a
Pee-wee's is a weird...
It's a weird movie, but
because from the outside, it looks so innocent.
It looks so innocent, but man, is that a weird
movie. And then
movie.
There's some, like...
Did you know that movie's in the Criterion collection?
Sorry?
I know. And I'm,
Criterion are just out here, like... They put Shuffle Film and
like,
whatever
it is. Such an odd choice, but I'm all there for it.
There's such an odd collection. There's Pee-wee's, and then there'll be, like... Harakari? Is that how you pronounce it? Yeah, and then there'll be, like... The Jackie Chan box set in the Criterion Collection.
Yeah, and it's such odd choices, but I'm really there for it. And yeah, next, like probably Beetlejuice is probably next to be put in the collection there. And then he makes Beetlejuice in 1988, and then Batman in 1989, and then Edward Scissorhands in 1990. And that is four back-to-back-to-back movies that are just massive successes. And he is like, and then he wants to go like, okay, I want to make my Nightmare Before Christmas story poem that I... made back at Disney, and I want to turn that into a movie. And he realizes, oh, it's back at Disney. So he goes back to Disney to go get back, to go get the idea again. And there's a very important thing to understand when looking at this movie and why it got made. The Disney of 1990 is a very much, was a very different Disney from 1984. The Disney of 1984 was in a complete mess where nobody was watching their movies, nobody was going to their theme parks, nobody was watching their TV shows, nobody was doing anything. The Disney of 1990, 1991 is very, very different where there was like a bunch of like corporate shakeups and stuff like that where Disney was trying to become more trendy. Like have, for example, there was like Captain EO at Disneyland, which was them teaming up with Michael Jackson, the Star Tours. Where, you know, they team up with Star Wars and George Lucas before they even bought it. They had Muppets 3D, you know, with Jim Henson and stuff like that. And they were just really expanding to work with all these big, big people. Their film division was getting better. This was very different from the days of The Fox and the Hound and The Black Cauldron. This was, like, the time of, like, The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast, where it was, like, they were making back-to-back hits. So they wanted to work with Tim Burton, like, really badly. So... when he was like, I want to make a stop-motion movie, they're like, sure. Sure, we'll let you make a stop-motion movie. And then, do you know anything about Henry Selick?
He directed Wendell and Wild.
That's not a pick. They're like, yeah.
And something else. I can't remember. He directed something else.
Yeah.
I don't really know a lot about him as a person. Yeah. He did James and Giant Peach.
Yeah. So basically, Henry Selick was one of those people who were taken from CalArts with Tim Burton. And he worked at Disney as well. He was also that kind of guy. He was just... really fed up with just like the Disney style and stuff. Yeah, and he left Disney. He did a lot of like bumpers for when MTV was just starting up. I think he came back to work at Disney, I think. And that's why Tim Burton was really busy working on a movie that we've already talked about, Batman Returns. So it was like, and because of how long it takes to make a stop motion movie, he was like, I can't make Batman Returns and Nightmare Before Christmas at the same time. I want to give it to someone who I can trust, and that's why it's directed by Henry Selick.
But Burton did a lot of directing work on it as well, no?
Okay, it's kind of complicated, because depending on who you ask, it depends on how much Tim Burton was there. I can't remember where I saw this, but apparently Tim Burton only came to, like, the set, like, 4 days out of, like, the 3-year production of the whole thing. So there's that, but some people say like, oh, he was like a really big force in directing and stuff. And that's why a lot of people think it's his movie. It's kind of debatable in terms of how much this is his. It's all his characters. It's his story, along with Caroline Thompson. But Henry Selick did direct the movie. So you have that, that's the whole thing. And the stop motion in this movie is just, it's really good. Like, you know, especially in a time where, like, stop motion isn't really that prevalent. You don't really see it. It's all CGI. It's, like...
it's good. It's smooth.
Yeah, it's really smooth. And
but
like,
it also contributes to the style, I think, a lot. Like, yeah, the way one, that it's done, it kind of helps reinforce the point of it.
And I always think, like, it's really incredible to see, like, stop motion movies. Most of them are actually Halloween-themed. Which, you know, you have, like, Coraline, and then you have Paranorman and stuff like that. And, you know, even some of Aardman's movies, like, they have got, like, a Halloween kind of theme behind them. And it's quite interesting. I don't know. Maybe it's because, like, kind of the jerkiness of stop motion. They've always kind of gravitated towards Halloween. But a lot of them are quite, like, Halloween themed. I think it really helps this movie. And, like, with this movie, it has a really, like, I don't know how to say it. It's got this really...
Wait.
Like, it's very different style to most of the Halloween movies that you'll see, like, around, I think.
Yeah.
And also, I think that contributes to Henry Selick and Tim Burton in film are two quite enigmatic people in their style. When you look at films like, you were saying, Batman Returns, you look at the new Wednesday stuff,
mm-hmm.
Coraline for Henry Selick, like, even James and Giant Peach was a Roald Dahl story, which mm-hmm. is for kids. It still has this very, like...
Kind of twisted.
I don't know, like, morbid appeal.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the right word, where it doesn't feel like something that should be successful, but it is.
Yeah, but it is. And it's like... And I've always liked that about stop motion, and especially in this day and age where, like, I think I saw some time back, like, Pirates of the Caribbean 5, Salazar's Revenge, and there's a scene where a giant CGI skeleton shark jumps out of the water over the top of their heads. And I'm watching that and I don't feel anything. Because CGI works on a plane where it's like, you're supposed... It works on a plane of like, it's so... It's kind of gone into the point where it's so obvious it's not there.
Yeah, it's like... I don't know if you ever... Did you ever watch Gravity Falls? It was around in, like, 2012.
Yeah, I've seen a bit of it, yeah.
There's this great episode where one of the characters reveals that she's afraid of stop-motion characters. So they go to this guy who makes stop-motion movies. But the old ones... Yeah. You know, like, before CGI, they'd have a real actor fighting stop-motion monsters because they didn't have
Like the kind of, like, Ray Harryhausen.
Yeah, like Ray Harryhausen, stuff like that. So they basically go to the guy that made that. And it kind of shows you that stop-motion... is severely underrated in its creative ability. A lot of people use it as like a placeholder for CGI.
I know.
Like in kind of, if you look at the big scheme of like film technology, you have like painted backgrounds and then there's like stop motion characters and then there's CGI and people just think it goes like that. But the actual world of, the world of stop motion, it's like there's so much creative stuff you can do with it.
Yeah.
And when you look at a film like Nightmare Before Christmas, it uses very creatively the stop motion thing.
Yeah.
Because it's not trying to be a realistic movie.
Yeah, it's not realistic. Like there's
like
bits
the
where
hill
you can,
where it goes round.
Yeah, there's bits where you can literally see the string and stuff like that.
It's
like
a morbid, like,
I know.
That's the idea, is like it's telling a fairy tale
mm-hmm.
as a fairy tale looks.
Yeah, it's similar to how I feel about like many like 80s and 90s, like how I think they kind of bring it back sometimes in the new Star Wars movies with like the 80s and 90s puppetry that you might see in stuff like Gremlins or like the Dark Crystal, where it's like Labyrinth or like something like
that. Yeah, because the Dark Crystal was
Yeah, but like you look at that or like some of the Muppet movies where like you have them riding bikes and stuff. You're like, okay, I know these are like puppets and I know they're not really real, but like they feel real. They feel real. I don't know how to explain it. But
Sorry. The Dark Crystal is fine. It's the TV show that came out in 2019.
Yeah, that thing lasted for like a season or something like that.
The cast is actually really good as well, which was really sad about it. It had like Mark Hamill, Taron Egerton, Anya Taylor-Joy.
I think it was a co-production with George Lucas, I think.
Awkwafina, Will Matthews, Jeffrey Adis. Jim Henson helped write it.
Yeah, he directed it, the original Dark Crystal, along with Labyrinth.
Yeah, and he helped write the Dark Crystal TV show.
I think he was maybe passed.
He was dead.
Creative Control.
Creative Control. Oops.
With this, is this the first musical we've ever done?
Have we done La La Land?
I don't think we've ever done a musical before.
I feel like we did. We might have done La La Land.
What an odd movie! What an odd movie to
what
do
an
as a
odd
musical.
Musical song. What? Okay.
Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah.
No, it's described as
a music is very important to that movie.
But it's not a musical.
It's not a musical.
It's described as a musical, but where they would be singing, it's fight scenes instead.
Yeah.
So it's got the musical structure, but it's not a musical. Okay, let me get this out of the way, just because it's quite integral to my film taste, and I feel like it should be known. I'm not a musicals guy in general. I find them a bit silly and a bit stupid at times, and it feels a very unnecessary way of telling the story.
But that's really funny, because like I cannot get enough of musicals.
However, that comes with a crux. a film like La La Land, and yes, I know, La La Land is the musical for people who don't like musicals. I get it. But if a film uses the musical, like Sound and Music, uses the musical aspect in a way that is creative or actually helps tell the story, like in Nightmare Before Christmas, mm-hmm. where the music actually feels like it's supposed to be in it, not like High School Musical, where it's like, why are they singing? That's not...
It's part of the charm of that movie.
Doesn't
it's
help.
Part of the charm.
Or Grease. Why is everyone suddenly two separate gangs, which if you've
seen... Is that how you feel about West Side Story as
If you've seen or read The Outsiders, is not a fun and games singing around thing. Why are they suddenly synchronized up singing, you know?
Yeah, and it's that's very interesting, like, to think about with The Nightmare Before Christmas. Because
yeah, there's not too much music.
Well, actually...
But like, when the songs are used, I think it helps. Yeah. And also, it is essentially what I would call... It's like... What's it called? I'm thinking of Harry Potter. Like, bard stories, what are they called? You know where they, like, sing with the little lyre and they, like, tell the stories? It feels like that, where it's like a musical.
Yeah.
Like, it's supposed to be a musical. I think it wouldn't work if that's it wasn't a musical. Like, when you watch Corpse's Bride or something.
Yeah.
I didn't know that was going to be a musical when I watched
it. Yeah, I didn't know that
but
either.
But it kind of works.
It kind of works. And something that, I don't know why I learned this, but something that's really good when you watch musicals is that you think... Once you finish, when you're watching the movie, you're like, okay, can I take the songs out of the movie and the movie still functions? Like, you don't need the songs. This movie, the songs are so important to it. And something that's really interesting is...
Some of it, though. Like, Halloween Town is a cool song, but it's not...
What a number.
It's not necessary to the film, if you know what I mean.
No, but it's like...
It's like Jack's Lament.
Yeah.
Very necessary to the film.
God, is that so atmospheric. But it's like... Something that's interesting to see is that I'm looking right now, and this movie has, like, 8 songs?
And that's all it needs.
You compare that to, like, at the time, like, the Disney movies at the time, like Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin and stuff. They had, like, 4 songs and stuff like that. And it's like, this movie is
But that
very...
was those were less musicals. That was more just, like, the gimmick song of the summer, if you know what I mean. Like, there's this number, which... works in the premise of the film. They don't really need it.
But you can take
it
out. You can take it out. Like,
it's just a cool little thing that gives Disney a bit more like money.
That's how I feel about like something like Can You Feel the Love Tonight in The Lion King. You know, it's not really that.
It's a cool little number.
It's a cool little number, but you can kind of tell with Disney, you're like, okay, we need to make a number that is going to hit the top chance. And it did, you know.
Although, quick little aside, what I was saying about La La Land, that there's one song I really can't do. It's the final one, the audition song. Where she's like, here's to the fools that dream, feels really unnecessary. The bit immediately after with the cool, like, sad jazz music and the them dancing around the movie set that, like, runs through the film in, like, 10 times speed. It feels like you're skipping the entire premise. Really cool. Just that little audition tape bit.
Yeah.
I've listened to that soundtrack, like, 8 times. I have it on CD. It's really great. But that one song can't do it.
Something that's interesting to look at this when you're watching this movie, especially when you look at like modern animated movies and even animated movies at the time, this movie doesn't really have any like pop culture references.
Yes. Well,
it doesn't have any, which is really weird to see, especially not even just like, I'm not even just thinking now with like where we live in like a post Shrek landscape,
like Mulan,
where everything is just like pop culture. We have to like, you know, we have to like spoof modern culture and stuff like that. Because even at the time,
yeah, like
it was
Mulan came out in relation to
98.
It.
That's 5 years.
So not that far.
This came out during the
Eddie Redmayne was cracking jokes the whole time.
Eddie Murphy.
Yeah. Sorry, which was not remotely the same person.
Yeah.
That were like. They you know make loads of references to time.
Genie and Aladdin.
That whole movie, he's just spoofing.
Like, as much as I love Aladdin, and I really do like Aladdin.
Great movie.
I don't think I would enjoy the movie if I didn't have the kind of knowledge in like what the genie was referencing, because that movie is you watch that movie and you're like, yes, this movie came out in 1992. There's literally a not joke in that movie. I can't believe there is somebody going something, not. Like, I've never heard someone make a joke about that in like 10 years.
Was
a not joke ever even a thing?
But you do realize like, for that movie, they signed him on to be the comic relief because they felt like they needed it. He was basically just asked to do stand-up.
Yeah.
And then they just cut whatever they didn't need. Like, they gave him like a script. I don't know this for a fact, but it sounds quite right. Is they would have given him a script, and the script had maybe 20 minutes less of the genie than they were supposed
to
be.
Yeah, yeah. There was a lot of riffing.
It's like, Mrs. Doubtfire, right? Which this would never be done.
I think that entire opening was just him, like, riffing.
Yeah, no. Mrs. Doubtfire, he made up, like, most of it on the spot. Yeah. To the point there is a PG cut that we saw, a 12 cut, a 12A cut, a 12 cut, a 15 cut, and an 18 cut of Mrs. Doubtfire. Because of how much he would just make jokes.
We should do Mrs. Doubtfire. I've not seen that movie
like,
in a long
there's,
time.
There's versions of that which is borderline Mrs. Brown's Boys, which is just like, it's just him like...
Yeah.
It's like, it's probably amazing because it's you know, to be fair, it's the guy who was in Jack, but like, he's amazing otherwise.
Yeah, but like, with this movie, I watch it and it's like, this is a very timeless movie, even to the point where it's kind of simplistic. Like, there's a bit in this movie which I know I'm not really supposed to find funny, but it's just so funny to me, where I think the doctor, Dr. Finkelstein, tells Jack like, curiosity killed the cat, you know? All he goes is like, I know. There's no joke there. That's not, he just says, I know, and they move on. It's a very simplistic movie, and a part of that I kind of like, because a lot of movies nowadays like to be, like, have a lot of pop culture references, and like to be very complex and stuff like that, and try to be smarter than they actually are. This feels like a fairy tale, and, you know, that's really great, you know?
The other thing that's kind of good about this is they don't overcomplicate it with characters.
Yes.
A lot of Disney movies have so many characters in it, or they reference so many characters, or they try so hard with the world. Like,
and you end up just, like, none of them leave an impression.
Like The Little Mermaid, which was very much around the same time.
4 years before? Yeah, 4 years.
So many characters in that, or so many references to characters.
Well, for me, it was like...
You have what looks like, I don't know, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, and all the characters
like maybe
you remember.
20 characters max, and all of them are quotable. Oogie Boogie.
The fact that the devil is in this movie and he's just a random resident, that he's not even the most evil guy there. The devil is just a random guy.
He's in this?
Yeah, I could probably find him, but it's just like, he's just a guy in this world.
Like Star Wars as well, you know, the cantina, there's just the devil.
Really? Oh my God. And it's just like...
For me, it's like, you know, in... Futurama. Have any of you seen Futurama? I know you're a huge
fan. I don't want to live on this planet anymore.
Have you seen it?
I've seen bits of it.
I love Futurama. So there's a bit in it where this robot, the robot devil, and he turns up all the time. He's like a recurring character in the show. And he's not even that bad. Like,
just a guy.
Bender's worse than him, and Bender's like a considerably, like, show, if you've never seen that show, we should do a couple of episodes of that. It's actually hilarious. Bender, the stuff he gets away with, the jokes they get away with because it's robots.
Kiss my giant metal.
Like, there's an episode where Bender gets his bomb stolen by a parts dealer. And he's like, who stole my ass? and he goes, are you going to buff those scratches out? It's so funny.
But, like, with this movie...
And he's a full-on, like, drinking cigar addict.
I don't know how that works.
And
but, like,
robot devil is just, like, comparatively not that bad of a guy.
The thing with this movie is... all those background characters, they're all so cool. Like, you know, at the beginning, you see, like, the clown with the tearaway face. And, like, that's really cool. And, like, you have, like, the three vampires. And then you have, like, the guy with, like, the spiders in his hair. Also, it's kind of, like, cliche to call, like, Tim Burton characters creative. But, man, I really do miss 90s Tim Burton. So creative.
What happened in Wednesday Season 2?
some of those stop-motion bits in Wednesday Season 2, I will give, are pretty cool.
But then some of it is just Netflix.
I don't really want to get into my take on Wednesday.
He's fallen off a bit, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And we kind of got to come to him because he's one of my favourite characters in the show. Who is a side character? He turns up for one song... and two scenes either side of it, Oogie Boogie. I don't know what his actual runtime in the film is.
Oh, probably like 10 minutes.
He's in it for his song, obviously.
Yeah.
He's referent. He's he's 10 minutes of screen time. You got it on the dot.
Oh,
that's incredible.
Wow. No, I was just thinking, like, he's in, like, the ending and, like, middle ending.
And, yeah,
you know?
He's one of the most memorable characters from the film. Everyone knows Oogie Boogie.
That, again, this is why I'm kind of, like, maybe this is why, and I'll get into why, like, how this happened, but this was probably why Disney was kind of scared to, like, release this movie, because it was, like, that scene at the ending where they tear him off and he's just full of bugs.
Yeah.
I was like 10 when the first time I saw this movie, and that,
yeah, that's really, really
kind of like, because he starts falling apart, and it's really like, ugh. The original idea was him to be body parts.
Ugh. You know? That makes so much more sense, but ugh.
Yeah, no.
But like, I don't know if any of you have seen Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children.
Yeah.
I'll die on the hill that that's not that bad of a movie. That's what I said. It's not that, but I watched it when I was like 11.
It's not that
and
bad.
And I read the book. The ghast things in that.
Oh my.
Like,
again, I was like 11 when I saw that movie, and that movie messed me up.
Like,
it was that, I saw that the same day as, I think it was like on like film 4, and they showed like Jaws 2, and then like Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, and that day messed me up.
Yeah, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. That's like, because that's a 12A.
Yeah. Most of that movie is fine, apart from the...
That is Tim Burton.
When the eyes start falling out.
That's like allowing Burton to do like whatever he wants without trying to make a kids movie. Because obviously Burton is kind of the master of kids horror.
Mm.
In
yeah.
the way that his movies are really scary, but for kids, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like Coraline in the... Yeah. It is scary.
It is scary.
But yeah. it's framed in a kids
like,
movie
nobody's
structure.
Having... Actually, unless like you're younger than like 8, I don't think anybody's having nightmares of like Beetlejuice or like.
No, but like, yeah, you know? But the thing that's cool about them is that they're, and I think this is key to A Nightmare Before Christmas. What makes it so good is it's a scary-ish. Well, this isn't that scary, but it's a scary movie. But it's framed in a kids' movie structure, so it has the structure of a classic kids' movie.
Yeah.
But it just has his like really twisted take on it. Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children does not have that.
Yeah, it's a very.
It's
complex,
just
like.
And the monsters in that thing.
Yeah, that's that. Again,
I went to to an exhibition for Tim Burton at the Design Museum in London, and they had the props used in his movies. So there was like Catwoman's dress and the little guys from Mars Attacks, and
that's so cool, man.
The faces they used for Jack Skellington, like his animated mouth faces and stuff. And coincidentally, they had the heads from the Whitgift monster things. And oh my god, they were terrifying in person. They were just this white shape with a mouth.
Oh no.
Ugh.
No.
It was so gross. And then that girl with like the head.
Yeah, the head on the back. That again, that messed that one.
And
messed
the bee
me up
kid.
Well.
Ugh.
Oh.
The whole thing is, and there was some art. The art he did to like inspire that was so much worse than the movie. I was like,
yeah, I always love mess because Tim Burton's art is always way more messed up than the final thing.
Yeah.
But with this movie, so when it was supposed to come out, it was supposed to come out as part of like the Walt Disney animation canon, where it was supposed to go, okay, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, The Nightmare Before Christmas, then The Lion King. It was supposed to be as part of that canon. And if you see the original sneak peek for the movie, they advertise it as that, like,
Some of the art for it is like, sorry to continue my point, but like, ugh.
Can I see?
It's like, it's obviously his, like, he got to some really weird stuff in the late 2010s. Like,
if
I don't know if you heard about Stain Boy.
That's what I was about to say. I've read,
have you not heard about
I have read some of the, his poems, The Death,
Teenager.
The melancholy death of Oyster Boy, and Stain Boy's in that collection as well of short stories.
So Stain
really
Boy
messed up, and I think there's like a one with like girls with pins for eyes, and it's
Stain
just
Boy
like
is this kid who I think kills his parents or something like that, but he's convinced he's a hero, but it's framed from his perspective, and they had this house that he'd made as a diorama for the thing.
I haven't read all of them, so I didn't.
And it was just blood all over the walls, and then this kid and a Christmas tree. I was like, what the hell? And then
that book's an interesting
there's
read.
There's a piece of art that he did called Teenager. This is all a bit later, but it helps perspective-wise to justify a thing. It's gross. It's a kid. And he's like weirdly tall, and then one arm is huge with pimples on it, and the other one isn't. And it's titled Teenager, An Awkward Stage of Life.
He just doesn't make those into movies, because I show up, instead of like doing whatever
also,
he does now.
Like, in his childhood pictures, he looks like a serial killer.
Oh, yeah.
He looks like he's going to eat me, like, alive. He's terrifying.
But it's weird, he looks way more normal than he, like, without all the crazy hair and stuff.
Yeah.
But when this
when he was like 20 years old, he looks just like a normal dude. He just had long hair. He's just like an average dude. And then before and after that, he's just a complete psychopath.
But like when this movie was coming out, it was under like the Walt Disney Pictures label because that was how they were going to release it. Like I've got the, they build it as like the next big.
The next picture in the thing.
Yeah, so it's, it was the kind of thing where it was like, oh yeah, we make all the...
Tradition, it was not.
I know. Graphic techniques introduced in 101 Dalmatians. The combination
of animation and live action in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Oh, they're acknowledging Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, that's, and it's really, it's part of the story as well. And then it's like... Pictures is joining forces with Tim Burton, the creative genius behind Batman. So it's that kind of thing where it's like...
Great, Disney and a horror director. How bad could
like,
it be?
They were like, okay, we're going to release this as this is going to be the next one. Then they show this movie to a test screening to kids, and the kids don't get it. The kids don't understand what they're going for here. I don't know what kids there are. If I was like a 10-year-old boy, I'd love this movie. I don't know where they found these kids.
No, you're
not
exactly like the main demographic.
I know, but like I was... No, even as a 10-year-old, I would have been... What kid isn't going to like this movie? But they were like, okay, kids don't understand this movie. And we can't release it under Walt Disney Pictures. So they kind of did the same thing that they kind of did with Who Framed Roger Rabbit, where they go... We have to release this under Touchstone Pictures. And Touchstone...
They did that for Dead Poets Society.
Yeah, so... Touchstone Pictures was the adult brand that they created in 1984 to release all their adult movies at the time.
Is it still a thing or has it been...
No, I think they did stopped in like 2010. And they released stuff like Down and Nine Beverly Hills, Turner and Hooch, Splash, Dead Poets Society.
Pretty Woman.
Yeah, Pretty Woman.
Armageddon. Oosh.
Armageddon. I think Sister Act as well. You know, a lot of those...
Sister Act is a crazy movie.
Come By Me Love, Adventures
in
Babysitting.
Oh, so they've been around for ages. They did Lincoln, Step Up.
Yeah, they kind of stopped.
They did The Help, The Proposal. War Horse. Yeah. Oh.
They kind of stopped.
Oh, Real Steel. Oh, dear.
They teamed up with DreamWorks Pictures during the end. And then I think Disney kind of lost their need for them because they started releasing...
Deja Vu.
They made the actual Disney Pictures label made their first PG-13 Pearl movie Harbor. With Pirates of the Caribbean, Curse of the Black Pearl. So it was kind of the kind of thing where like, oh, we can release PG-13 movies now. I think that's as far as they can go. They can't release like 12s.
I think if it's a 15, what do they release it on?
No, like, I can't even count...
Nowadays.
No, you can't count something like Deadpool and Wolverine, because that's under the Walt Disney Company, not the Pictures label.
No, they released that. There's not even them that released that. They put that through a distribution company.
That was, like, Fox. I can't even remember. Yeah, but...
But I don't know. Do Disney release 15s? What are they...
No, they don't. I think the most they've done is, like, Cruella, which I think is a 12. Searchlight as well.
Searchlight there.
But that's under 12. That's under... Yeah, that's on the Fox as well.
Yeah, I think they just give it to one of their subsidiaries.
I guess you can count like Lucasfilm movies, like Star Wars and that, and
but
Marvel.
But they didn't release that. That was
yeah. So it was the kind of thing they put it under Touchstone to like back it off, and to get a more of a teenage audience, they put the name of Tim Burton on the title. So like, if you see the titles, it's Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Oh, Henry.
And it's only now after the movie. So the movie came out, and it was like. It got really good reviews. It got nominated for Best Visual Effects at the Oscars, but obviously lost to Jurassic Park, which, you know, that movie was pushing, you know, CGI. So obviously that wasn't, it's not going to choose stop motion. But at the box office, it had a respectable budget of like 18 million. That's respectable. It made, I think, 51 million, which isn't bad. But it's not like the 500 million that like Aladdin made or something like that.
Yeah,
and then it was pretty instant. Like, look at a lot of movies like It's a Wonderful Life or like even some Disney movies like Fantasia, like Pinocchio. That took a while to grow an audience or something like that. Where it's like...
What's the other one that was very cult followed? That's very cult followed.
Or even like The Iron Giant or something like
that. Yeah.
Where it's like these movies came out, they bombed and it took... at least 10 years for them to grow like a volume. This movie, I was reading Tim Burton's autobiography yesterday, and he was writing, and this book was written like 1994, 1995, like a year after, and it's like, he was writing how people were like, where he found people wearing Jack Skellington watches, and just like, you know, wearing like the merchandise and stuff like that, and it's incredible to see how quickly this movie resonated with people. As soon as going to home media, it was like...
But I mean, of course, because then it... spurted the like unofficial trilogy.
Nightmare.
Do you not know about this?
There's this
intrinsic link between his movies, which is Frankenweenie,
Corpse Bride,
Corpse Bride, and
Nightmare,
Night Before Christmas. Yeah. And was there not another one?
No.
So those three all have a main character with a dog and a girlfriend who...
The guy is called Victor in both Frankenweenie and Corpse Bride.
And it's suggested he could be called Victor in Nightmare
Before Christmas. He's dead in Night Before Christmas, but he couldn't be. So he has a new
name, is the idea. Yeah. Then his dog is...
The dogs look basically identical.
And they all die, is the idea. And the girlfriend is kind of not really his, but not his, if that makes
sense. Yeah.
So they're all like... They all follow the same relationship.
And like, people have been saying, like, oh, there's a theory that they're all connected. And they're all in
small villages. And so the idea is that it follows the life of one dude all the way through.
Yeah, and that it's an interesting theory because, like, if you think that's true in order of when they're made, they're making them backwards. Like, Frankenweenie is last, and then... But Frankenweenie would be first, and then Corpse Bride, then Nightmare. It's an interesting theory.
But it's a nice way to think about it because they're the three movies that Disney produces for...
I think Corpse Bride was Warner Brothers, actually.
Oh.
Yeah. But it's basically like... It's a nice idea. And with this movie, like, I have the DVD of this movie, and Disney has done the thing which... They haven't even done this to Who Framed Roger Rabbit, I don't think, where they took off the Touchstone Pictures, like, label at the beginning of the movie when they re-released this movie in 3D in 2006, and they replaced it with the Walt Disney Pictures one. I have a DVD from, like... 2001?
It still has Touchstone.
It still has Touchstone in it.
Yeah, so anytime, even Dead Poets Society is still under Touchstone.
Yeah, it's still under Touchstone. And Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is a movie that Disney's kind of adopted, saying that, like, yeah, it's Touchstone.
It is still Touchstone.
It still says Touchstone if you go watch that movie. Nightmare is like, yeah, we released it under Touchstone, but it's a Disney movie, basically. And it's...
I guess they did too much promotional content to
get Yeah, that. It's kind of like, again, it's Disney saying... We've got to have money. and it's like, they saw that this movie has a big cult following and the merchandise is flying off. Yeah. So it's like, we can really take advantage of it. It's not like Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
And they did.
Yeah, it's not like Who Framed... It's a lot of Hot Topic stuff.
And Monopoly.
Yeah, and it's
Monopoly, Nightmare Before Christmas.
I was in Sainsbury's yesterday and already I saw, like, a Jack Skellington, like, costume for Halloween.
Oh, dear.
And
it's just like... Yeah. You know, they were like, and for the normal audience, for the suburban people, it's Christmas at Halloween. For the emo people, it's Halloween it's at Halloween Christmas, for
me, man. Like, and it's
so genius because you just take the people such, who love one holiday. It's
such good like
it's like Hop, the movie Hop. Yeah. It's like for people who are addicted to Easter. Yeah, but that's a Christmas movie.
No. Hop is like I don't want to get into
it. Hop is the only Easter movie.
It's so like that movie gets a lot of play. Are there
any other movies that are genuinely an Easter?
And it's
movie?
The same. It's the same thing for like Thanksgiving.
No,
like,
Thanksgiving.
It's like all you've got is like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And
there's no movie that's an Easter movie.
I know.
That's really weird to me. And there's not really a New Year's movie either.
Pizza Rabbit.
Peter Rabbit is not an Easter. Where it's like intentionally Easter. The subject is Easter.
Yeah, but like for Nightmare Before Christmas, it's such a gold mine because it's like, yeah, we can promote this movie at Halloween and then and like Christmas. All we have to do is wait a month for more money. And it's like, we can do it at Christmas. And
it is literally just for the people and who don't like Halloween, it's Christmassy.
Yeah.
And for the people who love Halloween, like...
Yeah. And since
really love it.
And since then, like, this movie has made, like...
The Jack Skellington crop tops are never
going to Yeah, that you always see it around. And it's like, this movie has made, this movie has made, like...
The Jack Skellington, who's supposed to be a scary, imposing, like, demon, as a soft plushy toy for Christmas.
Wow. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Tim Burton has been asked, like, I can see here, like, four times if he's ever going to do a sequel to this movie.
No.
He said that, like... He would rather leave it alone.
Yeah, because it's so like, good.
Some things are just better left untouched. Like,
yeah.
It's the kind of thing, like, he doesn't want to see Jack go to, like, Easter Town or, like, Thanksgiving Town. That's what he said. Like, you know,
that
Jack...
That would be awful. Can you imagine? Jack versus the Pilgrims in like... Yeah. Actually, there is another Thanksgiving movie.
What?
Free Bird.
We're going to go back in time to the first Thanksgiving to get the turkeys off the
that
menu.
That is Free Bird. That is a masterpiece.
Oh, my God.
Have you seen that?
not all the way through.
Oh, it's so good.
Classic right there.
It's so good. Are you not a fan?
Bits and pieces.
That's it's right. So good. We're going to go back in time to that first Thanksgiving to get turkeys off the menu.
And then they shrink the president. No, that's a Rick and Morty episode. Have you seen that? Where he becomes a turkey and he's like, Mr. President, you're a turkey. And they pick up the wrong one. And then they make a turkey president. And then it's so funny.
Yeah, so like, yeah, this movie is everywhere. I didn't even get into like, what his influences are. Its influences are like stuff like the How the Grinch Stole Christmas, the 1966 one.
66? Who's in that?
It's the Chuck Jones one, like it's
the original one. What did we think of the newest one?
I've got a soft spot for
Tyler, the creator did the soundtrack for it.
Yeah, he sounds so bored. He sounds so bored throughout the whole thing. He is waiting for that paycheck in that thing.
Tyler, the music.
Yeah, no, he.
The music's good. He does
He sounds so out of it.
No, he does such a cool rendition of the You're a Mean One.
Oh, I'll get it. No. Okay, after this. Let's end this.
Let's run it off. Okay, yeah, so we've got other things to talk about. Yeah. Okay, 4.5 stars, in my opinion.
Yeah, I've always kind of been like...
It's great for what it is.
Yeah, I've actually... And if I had a choice between watching this or Corpse Bride, I always choose Corpse Bride. Yeah. Because this movie is just... Something about it...
You don't want to watch it too many times because it's so magic the first, like, three times. And,
I never really understood this movie because it was so simplistic. And for a movie that came out around the time of, like, Aladdin and Lion King, these larger-than-life movies, this is a surprisingly small one. And I never used to understand that. And I think now, in, like, the past year, I've started to really... Really appreciate this movie, especially when every movie is trying to be the biggest thing. Yeah. Startup universes and stuff like that. This is just like, even a movie that does have a big universe, technically, is a really small introspective story. And I've always kind of respected this movie. Just
so.
It's small, it's nice. And I've 4.5. What I've given it.
Thank you for listening. We are Lucas and Ostra. Next week.
It's your choice.
I kind of need to decide. For those who actually listen and watch, which I don't even know if anyone's out there, but mid-90s or what was it called? Sound of Metal. Mid-90s is on Netflix or Amazon. Sound of Metal is on Amazon for free, so